everybody. It's Mary Shear, and welcome to another episode of Grow It Minnesota. Today, I'm talking to someone you may have heard of before. Her name is Heather Holm, and she's a popular author and speaker on all things related to pollinators. Today, we're going to talk about what home gardeners can do to welcome bees, butterflies, and beneficial insects into their yard. Let's get to the episode. Today, my guest is Heather Holm. She is the author of three books on pollinators, Pollinators of Native Plants, which came out in 2014, a Bees Identification Guide, which came out in 2017. And then last year, she did a book on wasps, which I suggest anyone who has middle schoolers or has a middle school library in your world, get them that book because it's just full of gross, interesting photos of insects doing things to each other. It's a great book. Kids would love it. Very comprehensive. And now you have a new book out. It's a pocket guide for common garden bees. Now, who's that for?
Yeah, that'll be for people just sort of getting interested in bees. So it'll be an introductory pocket guide, as you said, Mary. So hopefully it will introduce people to bee diversity, you know, once they start flipping through it. And it's for the folks that will say, I didn't realize there are so many different kinds of bees. So
yeah. There are tons of them. So tell me a little bit about, you are a native Canadian, is that correct?
Right. Yes. Yeah. And I grew up in Canada. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what brought you to Minnesota?
Well, my husband, who's American, is from Wisconsin, and we were, after we got married, we were living on the East Coast in Maryland, and we both just didn't like the population density and thought, let's look at moving back to the Midwest, and Minnesota made a lot of sense for us, given that my family would be flying and with the internet, the airport here. So we really look for work in the Minneapolis sort of area. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And are you a biologist by training or not a horticulturist per se?
I actually have a degree in horticulture in addition to biology. So my first foray into college study was horticulture. In addition to natural resources management. And then I sort of steered towards more general biology at the end of my studies. So I often think of myself as a jack of all trades and master of none, but have always had a really strong interest in plants and the natural world.
Yeah. Although I would say you are pretty much of a master of the pollinators right now. What prompted your big interest in bees and wasps and other pollinators?
Yeah, that was kind of an interesting journey. I took a lot of entomology classes, and then at the time I thought I didn't really see a career path with entomology. Mm-hmm. So, after moving to Minnesota and getting, you know, immersed in Midwestern native landscapes, working in them, that's when I really became interested in pollinators. I started to see these patterns emerging from year to year of flower visitation by very specific insects. And so it really sent me down what I call the rabbit hole, which I never came out of. And did a lot of self-study of pollinators originally. I joined a study group at the U with some researchers for a couple of years. So really got, you know, a lot of information under my feet, I guess. Mm-hmm. And haven't really looked back. I just find all types of pollinators really, really fascinating and interesting. And I can quite literally head out my front door on any day during the growing season and discover something new. So that really motivates me to continue trying to convey how amazing these pollinating insects are to the general public.
Yeah, they are amazing. And what's your garden like? I mean, I assume you have a lot of native plants and things that bring in the bees and the butterflies and all that.
Yeah, my garden, like all gardens, is quite dynamic. We did a lot of turf grass conversion when we first purchased our home almost 20 years ago. So I have a very small patch of lawn in the backyard. It's quite wooded. So I battle a lot of times just having enough sun to grow a diversity of different plants. But I have really transitioned my own home garden from being what you would think of as a formalized structured planting to more of a restoration. And I'm, really trying to understand ecological processes, even at a small garden scale. It helps me understand my other volunteer work, which includes doing a lot of ecological restoration. So, we can't build good pollinator habitat without understanding how to get good plant species diversity. And so that's really what I consider my home garden now, a living lab of, and it's not exactly pretty in some cases, but.
Yeah. Yeah. So can you give an example of some of those ecological connections that you've sort of discovered that on the surface of it, people say, well, I'll put in some Rudbeckia and I'll get the butterflies. I mean, we don't really think about all of the different processes that go into bringing in pollinators.
So for, any planning, and what I've really tried to focus on with my home garden is bee specialist plants. So we have about a third of the bee species in Minnesota that really have specialized pollen host plants. And so I've been trying to plant as many of those in my home garden and in neighboring restorations, just to see if I can attract some of these rare bee species and understand what their needs are. So for example, I have, three or four different species of dogwoods in my own yard. And I have one of four or five specialists now coming to the dogwood flowers to collect pollen. But it took a little while, but that's sort of part of the fun is planting these more rare species, not rare from a garden sense, but with the intent of attracting rare bee species.
Yeah. And people don't often think about like what that shrubs and trees, for instance, are really super important. They're more important than perennials are in terms of pollinators.
Yes, they certainly can be, especially in spring. You think of there's really not a lot of flower diversity in spring on the ground layer. So we have, our first woodland ephemerals bloom, but they're kind of short-lived. And then really the flowering trees and the large flowering shrubs really take up a lot of the what I call pollinator buffet space. They're serving up a lot of good nutritious pollen and nectar. And I always remind people to look up in the spring, because we're often sort of looking at the ground as a gardener and looking for some early pollinator activity. But often it's, at the first patch of willows in bloom or high up in a red maple tree, for example, is where all the bees are in early spring.
Right. And you don't see them, of course. Right. And you don't see damage from any of the insects up there because the trees and such are so big.
Exactly. Yeah. I have a ladder I carry around with me just to find some medium-sized trees that I know attract, pollinators in early spring, so I can get up a little bit higher to see what's going on.
Yeah, is that how you get all those close-up pictures that you have?
Yeah, I have a long-standing deal with my neighbor who planted some young red maples that I can come over in the spring with my ladder and hang out in their front yard for as long as I'd like to photograph the bees coming to the flowers. So
yeah, well, that is interesting. You mentioned that you're involved in restoration, and I know there's one like very close to your house that you're involved in. Tell me what these projects are about and how you go about doing them.
Yeah, I've got sort of three spaces in my immediate walking distance neighborhood. One is a city-owned park, which is just a woodland remnant, and we've been working in there removing invasive species for the last 18 years, and it's actually in pretty good shape now, pretty free of buckthorn, for example. The sort of novel project that we started around the fall of 2017 was an abandoned corner lot. It was an unbuildable lot in our city. So I approached the city and the watershed and got some watershed grant funding to do a restoration there. And that site was literally about 95% mature buckthorn. So it was very, very degraded. And so that has been another sort of living lab down the street of what can you do with these severely degraded sites and how long does it take to turn them around, make them more diverse, and how long does it take for the pollinators to show up, for example. So that's been a really fun project.
So when you say restoration, I mean, are you trying to restore the land to what it might have been, you know, maybe pre-1850 or, you know, sometime in the past? I mean, what are you restoring it to?
Yeah, it's really site specific. So the woodland remnant in the park and the neighborhood, that might be a good goal, is to restore it to a pre-settlement plant community target. We also have to take into consideration climate change and whether that is an appropriate target. That corner lot, because literally it didn't have any representation of what it formerly used to be in its pre-settlement condition, is what I call quite novel. And so I sort of took pieces of different local plant communities and incorporated different plants. It's never going to resemble, you know, a former savanna, woodland, or prairie that we used to have in Minnesota. But the intent is to have high diversity and for it to continue to be dynamic and functional over time.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of plants have you put in there?
The site is actually kind of nice. It's broken up into little, what I call micro habitats. So it has a pond. And so we were able to do a nice pond edge planting, including emergent aquatic plants, flowering plants along the shoreline where the soil is moist. We have a hot, dry, sunny road edge. So that's more planted with prairie species. And then in the middle section, we're trying to incorporate more hardwood tree species, such as oaks, and we have a red maple, for example, on the cool back slope. So given that it was mostly buckthorn, the only native tree species present currently are still cottonwood, box elder, and elm. So not highly desirable species from a restoration standpoint long term. So we're trying to reintroduce some of those later successional species to increase diversity.
And is the goal that eventually the space will sort of manage itself, if you will? I mean, that it'll just evolve, or what happens in the long term?
Yeah, we're letting it evolve and change over time. But right now, because it's quite a young restoration, and given the condition we started with, it still requires some intensive inputs. So we still have invasive plant pressure, like a lot of garlic mustard pulling in the spring, for example. But because we have been able to establish good vegetation cover on the ground layer, we're really starting to compete with any weed pressure. At the beginning, after clearing all the buckthorn, we had, you know, bare dirt and a giant welcome mat for every nasty plant that you don't really want in the site. But I would say probably last year we got over the hump, and we're on the downslope of less intensive management. And yes, long term, hopefully it will be in a fairly self-sustaining state. Although given it's in a suburban community, it's always going to have invasive plant pressure.
Right. And when you, just a quick question, because a lot of people ask about getting rid of buckthorn. How did you do that?
Yeah, we did all the buckthorn removal in the fall. So this was a big neighborhood project. So the watershed provided grant funding to pay for plants and a contractor to take out invasive Siberian elm trees. But a lot of the heavy lifting was done by volunteers. So we hand sawed and cut all of the buckthorn and then piled it next to the road. Since it was a city property, the city, their part, they came and picked up all of the brush, which saved us a significant amount of time. And then once we cleared the buckthorn, then we immediately started seeding and planting for a following spring planting.
Wow. Yeah. And did you have like a ratio of things like grasses to forbs, or, you know, did you, how did you go about thinking of what was the best, you know, division of plant material in a site like that?
Yeah. In an ideal world with an unlimited budget.
Where's that world?
Exactly. So our plant, actual physical potted plant material was concentrated along the pond edge, and with the woody species we reintroduced, then we had to rely on cheaper seed mixes, cheaper than plants, for that hot sunny part near the front. So we did a lot of seeding of native grasses first, snow seeding, followed by a diversity of different forbs. So we did some staggered seeding, some at the same time, but we're just starting to get good flower diversity. You know, there's always certain species that are dominant for a couple of years, such as black-eyed Susans, and then they fade over time, and other species in the seed mix start to show up and become more dominant. So
yeah. And I think that's the thing, people who put out a seed mix like that will often think, oh, it's great for a year, and then it's like, oh, I failed. The you know, it's not coming in. You know, there's no more black-eyed Susans or whatever they were looking for. But that's just how the mix develops, right?
Right, right. Yeah, and you have to have patience. You know, usually it's at least 3 years if you were seeding a prairie, for example. You need a lot of intensive weed management and perhaps mowing the vegetation. Mm-hmm. And it's not really until year three that it starts to look like a prairie if you've done the proper preparation before you started. So
yeah,
with this smaller restoration site, we, you know, are able to hand weed a lot of it. It's just less than a half acre. So overseeding with a diversity of different forbs really just enhances what we've already established.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that sounds amazing. So what year are you in on this project then? Are you up past year three or?
We are past year three. So buckthorn clearing occurred fall of 2017. Okay. So we're heading into our, I guess, fourth summer post planting and seeding. Mm-hmm. So hoping to see some new and different changes this year.
Yeah. Now, and is this the area where you saw the rusty patched bumblebee?
Yeah, well, I've had the rusty patch coming to my own home garden for several years. So once actually males and new queens coming to the site a year and a half after we cleared the buckthorn. And that was pretty surprising because you can imagine a year and a half, we didn't have a whole lot of flowering plants blooming. But given that there is a population in the neighborhood, they were able to find this new site with additional floral resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And tell people a little bit about what's the big deal on the rusty patched bumblebee.
Yeah. So the rusty patch is a federally endangered bumblebee species, and its range, it used to sort of occur most of eastern North America, southern Ontario, and then right around 2010, it just sort of suddenly disappeared from much of its range. So the range has contracted about 90%. And so here in Minnesota, southern Minnesota, central Wisconsin, Chicago area, and little spots here and there, south in Iowa and Illinois, is really the last remaining places that the rusty patch is observed. So there's a lot of emphasis here in Minnesota to restore more of its habitat, make sure we can prevent it from going extinct.
And do they know why it suddenly, you know, declined? The numbers suddenly declined in 2010 or around 2010?
Yeah, there's a number of factors that are believed to have caused the decline. One is an introduced pathogen from managed bumblebees. So in the Michigan, southern Ontario area, greenhouse growing tomatoes and peppers, and they would use managed bumblebee colonies inside the greenhouse. And it's believed that some of those bumblebees escaped into the wild and carried a type of gut pathogen that really affects certain subgenera of the genus of bumblebees, which includes the rusty patch. So that's one reason. And then, of course, all the others that are really affecting all pollinators, you know, habitat right. loss, pesticides. But why it's particularly affecting the rusty patch, no one has a single reason yet. Mm-hmm. But
yeah. You know. Well, that's interesting. So most of our listeners are home gardeners. So let's talk a little bit about what can a home gardener do. So if you put in some native plants or whatever, and you live in an area that's mostly grass and a few shrubs, does that make much difference? I mean,
yeah, I would say it does make a difference. So even though your yard may be small and you're converting, you know, a quarter to a third of your turf grass into perennial plantings, that doesn't mean that you're just this isolated patch and the bees will never find it. Because if you were to take a 50,000 foot view or a 100 foot view above your house and look at the surrounding neighborhood, you likely have patches of natural areas in nearby parks. You have other neighbors that are already have pollinator habitat. So once we start to piece back, even if it's in these little pockets, pollinator habitat, it really helps certain species move through landscapes to find new resources and limits the fragmentation that I talked about. So it may take longer in certain situations for the bees to find your planting, but often, mm-hmm. You know, a year or two, and you're going to see a real increase in visitation.
Yeah. And that actually has been my experience. I put in a bunch of native plants in the back, and they found it. They found it pretty quickly, actually. So any particular species people should sort of focus on if they, you know, plants that they want to bring in pollinators?
Yeah, that's a tough one. So many to choose from. Well, the general rule of thumb is to make sure you have a continuous succession of flowering plants. And people often forget about the early spring and late fall species. They're sort of summer gardeners. Mm-hmm. So that's often where I would suggest that you make sure you have, you know, those spring species, including some of the flowering trees and shrubs we talked about. If you have more shaded conditions, you can certainly plant some of the native woodland wildflowers that bloom in spring. And then the fall, of course, our goldenrods and asters are extremely important. And we have a wonderful array of different goldenrods and asters to choose from for different situations. And they goldenrods don't cause allergies.
I was waiting for you to say that.
Gotta check that box. And many are well behaved, so they don't behave like the Canada goldenrod, which is a really aggressive species. So there's right. plenty of goldenrods that are garden worthy.
Yes. And there's so many asters that can go from short ones to tall ones. And, you know, you could really do a whole section of asters alone.
Right. Right. And you can really fill almost mid-August to late October with different asters as a flowering phenology. Yeah. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah. And actually, one of my favorite fall plants is Boltonia.
Love Boltonia. Yeah, yeah.
you got to have room for some height, and it does like to move around. But
it does.
Gosh, it blooms really late, and it's very pretty.
It is. It sort of never fades to that ugly post-white flower either. It stays quite white, I find. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very pretty one. We'll put a picture of that in the show notes somewhere. Any other things that people should make sure to put into their gardens if they want to bring in pollinators?
Yeah, we didn't talk about the summer. So summer plants, bee balm is always a really good nectar source for some of the larger bumblebees and butterflies. Really, it's about thinking a little bit differently about garden maintenance. So, you know, the less disturbance, the less sort of management of your garden is more beneficial to not only pollinators, but other types of beneficial insects. So not removing leaf litter, not, you know, mm-hmm. raking, not, you know, mulching so much, thinking about plants as your weed suppression layer rather than mulch. So it's, you know, not just about the plants, but how we are managing the landscapes that can really benefit pollinators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if someone has shade, I know you have a lot of shade, any plant suggestions for that? Because that's a problem a lot of people say, well, I can't grow bee balm or, you know, whatever, because I have too much shade.
Yeah, I really like the native wood mints in the genus Blephelia, and they bloom, one blooms in late June and the other a little bit later. So they are sort of your bee balm alternative for shade for midsummer. In the spring, of course, I have a lot of Virginia waterleaf, earlier on bloodroot blooming. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to rack my brain for spring again. Golden Alexanders I like for a good May bloom, and mm-hmm. that supports a specialist bee. And in my garden, I have large-leaved aster, Lindley's aster, crooked stem aster, elm-leaved goldenrod, zigzag goldenrod, and blue-stemmed goldenrod, and those are all shade tolerant. So yeah. You can really find lots of things for spring and fall.
Right. So, yeah. So that would make your garden a lot more colorful then. And you don't have to just plant hostas. So
no, not shouldn't. Well, not with the quantity of deer in my neighborhood. That would be a fruitless effort.
That's true.
Sure.
Do you have a view on the use of these cultivars of native plants, which are becoming just incredibly available right now?
Right. Well, yeah, I kind of put on two hats regarding the nativar issue. You know, I put on the ecological restoration hat, and I think, well, they're not appropriate for places outside of gardens. I look at nativars as perhaps introductory plants from a garden perspective. So if someone doesn't want to grow the 6 foot tall Boltonia and they, you know, want to choose a short aster species instead, that's a cultivar, then that's a perfect sort of gateway into utilizing more native plants in your garden. There's concerns about outcrossing of, you know, nativars with wild type species, and if you are gardening next to a natural area, and those are valid concerns. But I really, you know, from my personal perspective, I'm always seeking out straight species and not planting cultivars. But I certainly understand, you know, someone just new to gardening and they may be not chopping at a native plant nursery. Right. That's sort of their best option if they go to, you know, your big box store or something that is offering natives. So
right. And I mean, even at the nicer garden centers, you have to look around and make sure you're getting a native rather than a cultivar, if that's what you're looking for.
Right. So. And I can understand if you're gardening in a quarter acre yard in Minneapolis, you can't perhaps fit these giant sprawling, you know, straight species in some situations.
Well, I don't know. I'm on a quarter acre in St. Paul, and that's where the Boltonia is.
All right. So, well, that's great to hear.
The alley. So. Okay. So, Heather, any other particular, are there bees we should all be looking for in our gardens? Are there particular species that are, and how do we identify, you know, like I've told you ahead of time when I got your book, the book your company published on flies for Minnesota, and discovered all the pollinators I thought were bees were flies, or at least some of them.
That's right.
What are some of the distinctive characteristics of common garden pollinators we're going to see?
Yeah, so pollinators can mean, you know, any organism that's moving pollen from flower to flower successfully. So beyond the bees that you may see, as you mentioned, flies, and there's that group of flies, the flower flies often mimic either bees or wasps. So unless you're taking a really close look, you may think you're seeing something completely different. And then, of course, there's a lot of pollination by butterflies and moths in some cases. So those long tubular flowers, you think of phlox species, for example. Our longest tongue bees, such as bumblebees, can't get into the nectar at the bottom of that long flower. So that's an example of a plant that's primarily pollinated by butterflies and moths. So it's really narrows down to specific plant interactions, whether a given flower visiting insect may be an effective pollinator. And then my new book, Wasps, sort of highlights the predatory wasp species that frequent flowers. So wasps as adults primarily feed on sugary substances, and that includes flower nectar. So they can do some pollination as well.
Right, right. And are wasps more likely to sting you than bees?
No, not at. Well, so really stinging occurs by social insects, social bees or wasps. So the most people are stung by ground nesting yellow jackets, which are a wasp, and they build a social colony below ground. So with the rest of wasp diversity, so we have, you know, 2,600 species in North America, approximately, of predatory wasps, and less than 1% of them are social and would be, you know, actively defending their nest and stinging us. So there's many different wasp species, large and small, out in the landscape that don't pose a threat.
Yeah. And that's one thing I've noticed. The more I garden, the more bees I have in my garden, the less afraid of the bee. I mean, I have, you know, just walk around, have no fear they're going to sting me. Though right. I have been stung by wasps.
You stepped on their nest, perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And that's kind of a nice distinction. I think if you think of your flower garden as the restaurant, there's no interest in defending the food. It's defending the house. And it's only the social species that are, you know, actively defending their house. So the bees, for the most part, most of our native bees, in addition to most of the nest-building wasps, have solitary nests. And the female building and provisioning that nest rarely defends it. So that's why there's very low risk of allowing bees to and solitary wasps to nest in your garden, because unless you were to grab one in your hand, which I wouldn't recommend, they don't really have any interest in stinging us.
Right. And most of them are nesting underground, correct?
Right. Yep. The majority of both are, yep, ground nesting.
What do you think of the bee houses that people put up for these are mostly leafcutter and mason bees, right?
Yeah. The sort of supplemental bee houses that you can purchase have tubes with a horizontal orientation, which generally attract leafcutter and mason bees. That's sort of become what I'd call overly commercialized. So, you know, every store you go into now is selling them. Some have very poor design, so they're quite shallow. So the actual tube length is too short. Whether it's a solitary wasp or bee nesting in that tube, the longer the length, the better, because they're lining up individual brood cells one after the other. And so they can get more brood cells in a longer tube versus a shorter tube. And if it's shorter, it's going to be really susceptible to predators. Right. So most of the larvae developing in that short tube would probably get eaten by something else.
Right. And that was actually my experience years and years ago. I had a bee house and I got a lot of leafcutter bees in it. And then there was a woodpecker.
That's the other predator.
Well.
Very tasty larval protein goo bags.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I was helping nature, just not the nature I was expecting I was helping. So
yeah. And the other concern is too that they do require cleaning and maintenance or replacement of tubes, and you know, people with great intentions have busy lives, and they may not be doing that regular maintenance that is needed. So I try and instead encourage people to do plant stem stubble. Incorporating a log lying on the ground in your garden can provide good cavity nesting habitat. So there's sort of less intensive ways to provide opportunities.
Right. And I've even seen videos of people harvesting the you know, the leafcutter or mason bees, keeping them in their refrigerator over the winter and then putting them out in the spring, which I never thought to do that. But
yeah, you know. It's particularly the mason bee, it's become a commercialized industry. So, you know, companies are shipping larvae or pre-pupa cocoons out to, you know, various places throughout the country. And that, again, it can be problematic because you're introducing species that may not be native to that area. Mm-hmm. There's risk of disease being coming with those shipped bees.
Right.
So I really err on the side of just plant the habitat and wait for the bees to come to you, not try and manage them.
Let nature take its course in that way. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Heather. I will put some links in the show notes for people to buy all your books and check them out and plant some native plants.
Thanks, Mary.
If you are enjoying Grow It Minnesota, please subscribe, follow, and give us a review over on Apple Podcasts. That really helps me reach more cold climate gardeners. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another show.